I'm going to call the Education Finance Committee to order, and our first bill is House File 2919, Representative Zawadzki. I see Representative Zawadzki has entered the room. And Representative, we don't have a quorum yet, so we're not going to move your bill, but we can start talking about your bill. And last week, we had a joint session with the Senate, heard about the facilities report, which I think was a very good one. And I think this has kind of come out because of that. So, Representative Zawadzki, if you want to tell us about House File 2919, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you for hearing House File 2919. I'm Mary Zawadzki. The Commissioner of Education was directed by the 2013 legislature to convene a working group on school facilities, and this bill provides funding for school districts that do not qualify for alternative facilities revenue. And so I will open it up to questions and ask the experts to come forward and help me out with that.
Okay. So here comes an expert.
Mr. Chairman,
good morning.
Don't know if I'm an expert, but you've got some important legislation before your committee today. For the record, my name is Sam Walseth. I represent the Minnesota Rural Education Association. That's a coalition of about 175 school districts representing about 160,000 students, none of whom qualify or are covered by alternative facilities financing. Mr. Chairman, members, you had a joint committee hearing last week and reviewed the details of the School Facilities Task Force report. We are here to fully endorse those task force recommendations and ask you to include Representative Zawadzki's important legislation in your omnibus bill this year. When the task force began its work last fall, there was a statistic that really jumped out at rural districts, and that was those districts who qualify for alternative facilities. It's large 25, covering about 44% of the student body, have purchasing power and are able to spend on average of $2.79 per square foot on their deferred maintenance. On the other hand, those districts who don't qualify for alternative facilities have the purchasing power and spend on average only 58 cents per square foot. That's approaching a 5-to-1 differential. And what that means for the typical rural district is they are left with choices of continuing to defer maintenance. It becomes almost a permanent policy, and we're not taking care of the taxpayers' investment in those buildings, or they are pulling dollars from the general fund that should otherwise be going toward programs for students, contract settlements, etc. And so we really believe that moving the ball forward on providing an equalized, flexible, larger, long-term maintenance levy is a major component of the equity puzzle here at the state capitol and for those students in greater Minnesota and actually many metro districts as well, too. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we're here today to thank Representative Zawadzki for her good work in getting this bill in, and we urge your support for it. And with that, I'll wrap it up and see if there are other experts here today as well.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Zawadzki, do you have other testifiers?
I do. Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I can try to keep it real brief and just say ditto to what Mr. Walseth said. But I did testify last week at your joint hearing, and we also thank Representative Zawadzki for bringing this forward. Very important piece of legislation. Our board unanimously supports the recommendations that the Finance Working Group brought forward. And probably the most important piece out of that is the long-term deferred maintenance component. And there's a lot of people that think all the metropolitan districts are in the ALT facilities program, and that's not the case. That's about half of our, a little over half of our members are in and half aren't. So it's a big issue for a lot of metro districts as well. So thanks, Mr. Chairman and members.
Mr. Kronquist, thank you so much. All right, any other testifiers? Ms. Representative Zawadzki, is there anyone in the audience who would care to testify for or against House File 2919? Is there any questions from the group here? And before we go on, why don't we do this? If you just hold up just a second, Representative Erickson. Mr. Strom, we have a run here. And members, you should have House File 2919 up on the top. Mr. Strom, would you care to just review that?
Mr. Chair, members, what's in your packet is a run that shows in the first column the adjusted pupil count. The second column, as was mentioned, there are about 25 districts that qualify for the alternative facilities revenue. You can see that totals $160 million or $175 statewide, but of course if you were to divide just by the qualifying districts, you'd get a number more like twice that. So you can see the total dollar amount and dollars per pupil for those qualifying. Then currently for the districts not in the alternative facilities program, they qualify for $64 per pupil in a program called the deferred maintenance program. That's shown in the next two columns. That totals $25.9 million. And then in the last two columns, well, a distribution is not entirely specified in House File 2919. Assuming that that were to be distributed at $53 per pupil for those who don't qualify for alternative facilities, that would have a revenue cost of $24.7 million, and you can see how that distribution is throughout the state.
Thank you very much. Representative Erickson.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was late. I had constituents here. But so school facilities improvement revenue would be a new coding then in our education funding stream? Maybe Mr. Strom could answer that. I mean, is that what it would be called, and these would be rolled in?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, there's...
Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I used to be a chair.
Yes. Yeah. Living in the past today, please excuse me.
Sorry, Mr.
Chair, committee members, under House File 2919, there's a one-time aid appropriation in Subdivision 2 for fiscal year 15, essentially to get us through the transition year. And then what happens in Subdivision 1 is revenue is built into the base with the instruction to the governor to develop and implement the proposals of the school finance working group. So essentially, that $25 million that's built into the base for fiscal years 16 and 17 could be done in any way that the governor sees fit, and the $25 million below would just be a one-time distribution.
Thank you.
Let's see, I think Representative Brainerd was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. You might remember when we discussed this last year that Mankato has sat on the edge of the square footage requirement for a number of years, and we've been 26th or 27th on the list, and I actually suggested we build a larger shed in our high school sports facility, but it wasn't taken up by the board, so we'll be very happy if this moves forward.
Thank you. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Swatsky, despite the good intentions of the bill, I'm interested in why we're directing the governor to include it in his budget instead of just budgeting it in our own proposal. So I haven't seen that before. I don't know, maybe it's a more common practice in the past, but why is it that you decided to go that route instead of just do it?
Representative Swatsky.
That'd be a good question. It is something that I think that he has referred to knowing that there is a necessity in this, and I think that then we can appropriate it, and it will be distributed, and the schools need it.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's sort of just a statement, Bill, that this is a priority for us, that we want the governor to lead and actually do it. It's an honest question. I've never seen this before. So if you really believe in this, and I think a lot of people on this committee do, let's just change this and do it. And let's allocate it and let's move it.
Representative Swatsky, any further on that? Certainly as this moves on forward, that language can be stricken. I mean, it's probably not necessary to the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to belabor the point, but this committee does a very good job of really digging into bills, and it's something that I think we all take a lot of pride in. And I've noticed in a few other committees we do exactly that. We're just saying, you know what, this has further to go. We'll just let somebody else fix it. I think, you know, it is our job to fix this kind of thing. If we're going to move this forward, let's make it the way this committee wants it to be. And if this is the way the committee wants it to be, that's fine. But, I think the discussion is important.
You bet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Thank you. Representative Swatsky.
I would agree with you, and if you so do so in CFIT, I would agree 100%.
Any further discussion on Representative Seltzer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a comment. I served on the School Facilities Working Group along with Representative Quam, and I wholeheartedly am behind the recommendations of the working group. And the wonderful thing about the working group is that the intent was not to create winners and losers, but to make sure that every student in the state of Minnesota is in a safe and adequate facility. So I just wanted to thank Representative Swatsky for carrying this forward.
And before, we do have a quorum now, so Representative Seltzer, do you want to move House File 2919?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move House File 2919.
Very good. And Representative Swatsky, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the point that we seem to agree that maybe the verbiage could be better and the separation of a power of, you know, I wouldn't hazard to tell you what. Now you shall submit this this budget. Is there a technical correction that the staff could do to take care of this, you know, agreed upon, you know, fuzzy or maybe not appropriate, and then we could actually do the technical correction to it before laying it over?
Representative Quam, probably not at this point. I mean, this bill is going to be laid over, but, you know, right now there weren't any amendments for the bill, and so again, it's going to be laid over. If it's included into an omnibus bill, there'll be more debate, and I agree with Representative Woodard. It's nice to get everything done up front if we can on things, but right now with the timing of things for this bill as far as amendments, there's no amendments that can be entertained. And I think this would be more than technical also, just that paragraph. So Representative Zawadzki, any final comments?
I thank you for hearing this bill and look forward to seeing you again on Friday afternoon.
Thank you very much. I'll lay over House File 2919 for possible inclusion into the finance bill. Thank you very much. Members, we have some minutes here for March 11th, 2014. Representative Wills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes from the March 11th, 2014 meeting.
All right, we have a motion to approve the March 11th, 2014 minutes. All those in discussion? Not? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does carry. All right, members, before we go on to the location equity revenue bills, there is another run landscape here, and Mr. Strom, if you want to go over that.
Mr. Chair, members, we had a brief discussion about this a week or so ago, and we'll have several bills on the agenda today dealing with the location equity formula. In an effort to get information on a single spreadsheet, there's many different ways we could go with the data, but some columns on here that may be helpful for members today. Some of the bills deal with a pupil unit limit. If you look in the first column there, that's the fiscal year 15 adjusted pupil units. That should help folks as they examine views bills with pupil unit limits on them. The three categories of data on here show the results of the provision that was in the tax bill last year regarding the referendum changes and the location equity revenue changes. The first group of columns shows that for those that were given the additional $300 per pupil of authority through board action, that was $16.8 million of authority they would not have otherwise had. You can see the list of who those districts are and the amount of revenue that they gained through that provision. The second two sets of columns deal with location equity revenue. And as we talked about briefly last week, there are really three advantages to school districts to location equity. The first of those was additional revenue for those school districts with moderate to low referendum amounts. And the way the formula works, if you're in the 7-county metro area, your district's eligible to receive an additional $424 per pupil. That amount comes off of your referendum. So if you have a referendum that's larger than the $300 board approved plus the $424, which is $724 in the metropolitan area, there's no revenue advantage to you for the location equity. So it's those districts with a lower amount of referendum where the location equity provided additional revenue. For districts in greater Minnesota with more than 2,000 pupils, the additional revenue was $212. For those districts, if their referendum board approved plus voter approved was greater than 512, there was no revenue benefit for them, and that's in that middle set of columns. Then finally, that last set of columns shows those districts for which the location equity, because it put more revenue in essentially the second tier of equalization, that there was an advantage, an equalization aid advantage of $17 million statewide for those 36 districts. That was additional aid they got and less property tax that they were required to levy. There was no revenue gain for that, but there was an aid gain in levy savings. And then finally, that third category, which does not show up on the printout here, was those districts for which location equity received a space under the referendum cap and could either last year or in some future year go to their voters to get additional authority. So the purpose of this printout is just to give you some of that background information as you hear the bills today regarding location equity revenue.
Thank you very much. Members, any questions for Mr. Strom on this? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, on the location equity revenue columns, could you just re-explain why the amounts vary under the gain slash APU? I've forgotten how that works.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, for a school district in greater Minnesota, the location equity revenue was an additional $212. Yeah. But that first is subtracted off their amount of referendum. So, for example, on the first page there, if you look down to the District 47, the Sauk Rapids Rice School District, the sum of their referendum at the time was such that they could only go another $142 till they hit that 512 limit. So that they received $142 of benefit under that. And so that's why there's varying amounts there. If a district were to have $511 of referendum authority, they'd only receive an additional dollar. If they had just $300 of authority or less, they'd receive a full $212 in greater Minnesota and a full $424 in the metro area.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Very good. All right. We will then move to House File 2256. Representative Dorholt. Would someone like to move House File 2256? Representative Bernardi.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2256.
Thank you very much. Representative Dorholt, welcome to the committee. And you want your testifiers to come forward, and you can start describing the bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sounds like we'll have an interesting day with location equity revenue here. And sounds like research mentioned some numbers there, which the St. Cloud School District may have missed that cut by $38. That's how close, the way I understood it. And when this bill kind of first passed, some school districts were under the impression that we would have been able to receive that full 400 plus at the last minute, but it didn't work out. This bill, 2256, would expand the location equity revenue to school districts with more than 7,000 pupils. And if you pick up on that, yes, that is kind of relates to regional centers. It would probably cover St. Cloud, Mankato, Duluth, Rochester area. So here to explain why this is very important to St. Cloud area as well as other regional centers, I have with me our superintendent, Willie Jett, and the school board member, Peter Hammerling.
Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. As mentioned, my name is Willie Jett, and I'm the superintendent of St. Cloud Area Schools. And just a little bit, I'm a born Minnesotan. I grew up in the Osseo District. I taught in Anoka Hennepin, the Osseo District, and Minneapolis schools. I was principal at Hopkins High School, and I was an assistant superintendent in St. Paul. And so I'm familiar with the financial challenges that are faced in the metro area. this is my first year as superintendent in St. Cloud, and when I was hired by the school board, I committed to maintain the many strengths of the district and also make a quantum leap in the quality of our efforts to address the educational needs of our disadvantaged students. And I've learned in this first year that the financial challenges we face in St. Cloud are as great as any financial challenge that are faced in the metro area. I'm in the Twin Cities today to speak to you, but also to try to recruit staff to fill five vacant principal positions and to attract teachers with training and experience from the metro area. The market for the best teachers, the best principals, who are transformational leaders, is not just a local market. Great teachers and principals who are willing to take on demanding educational challenges who can make a real difference are in high demand. And it will be a struggle to attract them to St. Cloud if I tell them that the district is expected to do way more with less financial support. A few facts about St. Cloud. Our English language learner population is about 15%, which in 2000 was at 3%. This population is primarily Somali students, Somali immigrants, many of them refugees. Students come to us, many without any formal schooling, and they come to us at all grade levels. Our special education population is at about 20%, and because we are a regional center, we draw a larger percentage of the area students with significant disabilities. We must subsidize our special education programs at the rate of about $8 million per year. Our free and reduced lunch population is at 54%, and it's growing. In 2000, it was at 25%. Our students of color population is at 33%, of which the largest percentage consists of English language learners from East Africa. Part of what we need to do in education is to use our resources more effectively, and we intend on doing that and continue to do that in St. Cloud. If you had time, I'd love to talk to you about all the things we're doing and intend to do that will have significant impact that don't involve more money. But one example is through negotiations this fall with our teachers, we added an additional 15 minutes of instructional time. But as you know, a number of things that are necessary do require resources. For example, we've learned that if we provide more teachers in the early years, we can over time reduce the need for more costly special education services in some instances. We've learned that if we add more and better trained professionals with non-speaking children come to us, we can get them fluent earlier and thus give them a better chance to thrive in a traditional classroom. Districts in the metro, and I've been reading this in the local papers here, districts in the metro have implemented AVID programs, achieved via individual determination, and they've been having great success. And as someone who's experienced that in the metro, we'd be struggling financially to implement AVID in St. Cloud for our students, and the equity adjustment will give us that boost. In summary, I'm urging you to add us and the other regional centers to the equity adjustment factor. That small increase per student can make a huge difference in combination with the non-financial efforts that we are making with our teachers, principal, and our community. This year, our operating referendum expires. If you don't approve this bill, we're going to be forced to run a campaign next November to prevent ourselves from going backwards. If we receive the benefit of the proposed equity adjustment, we can move forward without running a levy renewal. As superintendent, I'd like to be devoting our efforts entirely to implementing the transformational changes necessary for our students' success instead of the energy that it would take for levy renewal. So to the question, is it true that your district receives substantially more money? Not entirely true. Much of that money is what our business person considers hot money or deficit spending. For every dollar that the extra money that we receive, we are required to spend way more than that dollar the district receives. We get $17 million in special education money, but we have to spend $25 million as the price of receiving those funds. We call it hot money because it's money that forces us to spend at deficit levels. ELL money, compensatory money, Title I, all these monies are partial funding for challenges that cost more than the money that is provided with those funds. As a district with large compensatory funding, we appreciate these funds, but we are not financially better off than a district that has so few students in poverty that it receives no compensatory funding, because the compensatory funding is only partial funding for what goes with the high rates of poverty. I thank you for your time, and I thank you for listening.
Thank you. Any questions for Superintendent Jett? Representative Plum? Oh, no. Okay. Okay. Well, let's go to the next testifier. So, welcome.
Peter Hammerling. I am a parent and also a school board member, and I like to put that parent part before the school board member to kind of show where my priorities in life are. I will tell you, I graduated from St. Cloud Apollo in 1984, and back then, quite honestly, it was known as White Cloud. You know, it was a very rural, almost, but larger city. But we've changed. It's become a much different community. It's a community that's learning now to embrace this diversity. We've had some issues, but we're getting there, and it's working. But we are far more like a metro district than we are a rural district right now. We have the same issues, the same concerns, the same needs, and this extra funding would really help us address those. Also, being on the board, people asking, are we really doing everything, the right things with this money? Let me tell you, it's going to my fourth year on the board. We've made cuts. We've made adjustments. We're asking people to pare things back, and we're still having shortfalls and cross-funding that we need to do. And so we struggle, and we're going to continue to struggle unless we can kind of balance this out with some additional funding, and this is where the location equity adjustment would really help us out. Appreciate it.
Gentlemen, you know, the location equity revenue, I mean, the basis behind it had to do with the cost of living in salaries and so forth. I think that was the reason that came about. There was data showing that in the metro area, the cost of living, hiring teachers and so forth, was higher than in other areas of the state. And so I can't say I've heard that in your testimony, that rationale. So do you have any, Superintendent Jett or Mr. Hammerlink, do you have that information that would show by location a difference in salaries or cost of living, St. Cloud versus the Twin Cities?
To be honest with you, if you looked at numbers side by side, you would probably see that St. Cloud may not be at that same level, but I think that's changing as our workforce is looking to become, you know, a more educated workforce, and some of those things are changing. We're going to that. As Mr. Jett mentioned, as we're looking to hire people who are better qualified to work in our district, that cost of labor is increasing for us. I think just St. Cloud itself is becoming a more expensive place. It may not match it, but I just know living there most of my life, I'm seeing that that is changing, and so I believe it is getting to that point of where the labor cost is starting to increase.
Yeah, Representative Dorholt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but the St. Cloud area that is in Stearns County is often considered one of the highest rental rates outside of the inner metro area, so Minneapolis and St. Paul. So you could put our rental rates on par with that of the inner ring metro. That's kind of in some of the history, you know, large student population, but also shortage of rental properties. So that we have inner core neighborhoods where the prices would match that, once again, of inner ring, well, probably it's older housing than outer ring suburbs, but the area in general is pretty close to that of much of the metro area as far as housing stock prices go.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I echo your trying to understand the justification. You know, looking over the data, there appears to be a greater percentage of free lunches than you know, Rochester and some of the other areas that have the higher cost of living, because we had a study last year that presented that. But frankly, I see no concern for the students that I'm assuming that there are other school districts within the limits of St. Cloud or adjacent that are underneath the same impact of cost of living, competition for rental housing, you know, paying teachers. And if you look at existing statute, there are two areas that treat a little bit different. One by county in the metro, not by you know, special picked out school districts. The other is by any school district with any portion within a city of the first class are designated and treated differently. And I appreciate the reasoning and justification for equivalent funding. To me, it would hold more weight if you had similar language to what is standard operating procedure for the language. In other words, we're not just cherry picking districts, we're looking at location, which generally impacts more than one district, that we are looking at what was the original justification for this, and show that comparison. I don't have a problem with the bill coming forward. It's just I'm not hearing, as the chair is not hearing, that similarity to why there's this delta between the metro and the other districts. So I don't think that this style, you haven't convinced me.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dorholt, we've talked about this before, and I'm sympathetic to the intent of your proposal, and obviously my school district would benefit by this, but I am leery of this solution, partly because I think we lost some of the original intent of the whole location equity approach when we moved away from the idea of a formula. If we had a formula that related to actually calculating the costs that the chair mentioned earlier, we could more clearly consider its distribution among districts who have issues around those costs. But now when we identify geographic regions without looking at those cost factors or just looking at populations, we're making some assumptions about those factors. And I'm going to wait to hear the whole discussion around all these bills, but I'm really concerned that in an effort to create equity, we're actually creating more inequity, and that's my concern: is what the fairness is with this with this funding mechanism throughout the state.
Representative Radinovich.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I certainly appreciate this bill and the other bills that we'll see today. But I think that's the fundamental. We've sort of hit on the fundamental flaw with location equity revenue right now, which is that it presumes that, $424 per student in the seven-county metropolitan area represents a cost differential in educating a child, and then half of that cost is what would be incurred in districts with more than 2,000 enrollment across the state. And I think that if you look at any evidence, cost comparisons, it's more of maybe like a 15% differential in general cost of living between metropolitan and rural parts of the state. In my situation, you have a district like Brainerd, which receives location equity revenue, which is 15 minutes from Crosby, which receives no location equity revenue. And so to presume that it's $212 more expensive to educate a child in Brainerd than it is in Crosby, I think, gets at the very flaw with this. Now, I would, and, I've got a bill to address that, but I do think that the real issue here, and we'll get into this, is protecting a certain standard of education, and I think these levies are better applied for a different purpose than to accommodate location equity. I do believe that by allowing the school boards the discretion to levy for these dollars, though, that they are able to make those decisions about what it costs to educate a child in their area. So I support the levies in concept. I just think that the formula that we're working under, the paradigm we're working under, is wrong.
Representative Hertoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to echo some of the concerns that have already been addressed. And I would just remind committee members that even with regard to the Voss report, that the school districts that did get help and got benefit from the changes that were implemented during the last session are also the areas that are highest in the state with regard to the property tax burden as a percentage of household income. The West Metro area has averages that are near 5% of household income just to pay property taxes. So location does matter, and these school districts have smaller student population and lower tax capacities, which makes it harder to fund their operations. So I echo what Representative Reinert said and agree that in an attempt to spread the money around, you take away and homogenize what is inequity into just being another pot of money for every school district to grab.
Oh, that's never true.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what happened last year with the location equity and the board approved referendum is that we further brought flaws to our education funding formula, because now we have more losers than we have winners, and you know that's not the direction we should be going when we're looking at our students and funding them in Minnesota. Moreover, the stacking occurred, correct? The department decided that that was okay. I know that my Princeton district questioned whether or not they could do that, and I sent them right to Mr. Milcher, so I'm sure he got a few calls. But, you know, that exacerbated even more this issue. I sympathize with St. Cloud. They're a regional center, and I know what's happening in our regional centers. We're getting population increases, and in many instances, they're immigrants. They don't speak English, and so I know the needs in St. Cloud are great because I spend enough time there being a part of the St. Cloud Chamber to know that. But, you know, at some point, Mr. Chair, we have to make a decision about what we're doing with education funding so that we look at a student as a student, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the money should follow the student, and we shouldn't worry about where they are getting educated. They should all be worth the same amount. And at some point, I hope that we reconsider the direction we're going, because we have one Band-Aid after another. And I've seen it over the years I've served now. And this further, as I said earlier, exacerbates the issue. And, of course, we're going to have bills now to repair it. And that's just going to make the problem even worse. I mean, it's going to help, and yet it's going to harm. So, you know, let's think about that for our future. And take a step back, take a big breath, and ask ourselves, how can we ensure that every student is looked at as equal in the eyes of funding and treat every school district that way, instead of offering them this carrot and that carrot, and then in the end, we just have all of this feedback. I know I have a superintendent in the audience who's going to testify, I'm sure, in a few minutes, because, you know, Malacca got left out. Mm. They're in the donut hole. So, you know, what are we doing?
And, of course, this is our first location equity revenue bill today, so we're kind of having the discussion now. So as the testifiers, just bear with us here on this. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think if we want to respond to the needs of every student, we need to respond to also the needs of their and the reality of their communities. And the Commissioner's Task Force on the Reform of the Education Funding Formula, which was not its name, but I think you know what I'm talking about, the School Funding Task Force did look at different costs to do the same thing in different parts of the state. And the metro area and the regional centers had higher costs. And you can see that. And you can see St. Cloud, according to Zillow, which is a real estate website. It's got some challenges, but it's at least commonly quoted in the media. Average or median home price in Stearns County is $154,900. All round up, $155,000. Olmsted County, $159,000. So a little bit more. Average home value, and I didn't get this one off of Zillow, but I can assure you in Hennepin County, Representative Hurtas probably knows it off the top of his head, but is above that. Contrast that with Cass County, where the median home value is $106,000. To get a house in Cass County, a comparable house as to the metro area or a regional center, costs significantly less. Lyon County, Marshall, $113,000. So there are real differences in the cost of doing business in different parts of the state. And I think the unfair thing, then, is not recognizing those differences. What is it? In special ed, they have a saying about the most unfair thing is to treat everyone the same, because everybody isn't the same, and every community isn't the same. And I think if the more we recognize that, the more responsive our schools can be to the communities and the children they're in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Dabney. I guess with that, Superintendent Jett, Mr. Hammerlink, after kind of hearing this, any kind of last comments you have? I want to have you guys have the last word, anything. And I appreciate very much the testimony and, you know, talking about the special needs of the district. And I have to commend Representative Dorholt. He is in my office quite quite frequently talking about St. Cloud area issues and that, so I appreciate that very much. But anything you'd care to add to this discussion?
I appreciate, thank you, Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Dabney, pointing out some of those statistics. And sometimes it's very hard to gather statistics with a city that's in three different counties, and that we do. I do only have one school district, which is St. Cloud. I appreciate you all taking on a rather complex issue that wasn't in the K-12 or education bill, but it's, as you see, vitally important to the success of the children in our school and the success of the St. Cloud area.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here in the audience that would care to testify for or against House File 2256? Okay, seeing none, Representative Dorholt, were those your final comments, or do you have more?
Thank you very much for taking this on today.
Thank you very much, and Superintendent Jett, Mr. Hammerlink, thank you so much for being here. So I will lay over House File 2256 for possible inclusion into the finance bill. Thank you, Representative Dorholt.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda, Representative Norton, House File 2585. Anyone care to move that bill for Representative Norton? Representative Reinert moves House File 2585. Representative Norton, welcome.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'm bringing you a different opportunity to look at a different way to look at the location equity issue. And it's my pleasure to address you today, and I have with me Superintendent Mike Munoz from the Rochester Public Schools, and he'll speak in a few moments. First, I want to thank this committee for their work last year in moving forward education funding. I think it benefited our district and districts across the state and was a really good start. It isn't the solution, perhaps, that the Minnesota Miracle 2 discussed over the years when I was serving on K-12, and I know Representative Reinertz is referring to some of the larger ways that we could be looking at funding schools, and we just haven't been able to do that here in the state of Minnesota. So fixes like the one you saw last year, and particularly in the tax committee that addressed location equity revenue, are just additional efforts to try to address issues that our districts are facing. Rochester is a regional center. Our needs are different. Our cost of living is higher. Housing is higher than many parts of the state. Services cost more, and wages, we have to pay higher wages in order to get quality employees in our region. So we do face challenges similar to the Twin Cities metro area, and I think our superintendent will talk about that just a little bit more. I just want to acknowledge the great difficulty you have here and some of the comments that were made. I think they're very worthy, and you have a difficult task ahead of you. While I'm bringing forward one tiny solution, or at least one option for you to consider in dealing with this, and the option that I'm bringing for you is that you have it's a first-class cities solution. So it's districts that at least are whole or at least partially or wholly in a city of the first class would be considered for that higher location equity amount. It's one solution. But the donut hole is very real. We have a consortium of superintendents down in southern Minnesota that have met with us. Superintendent Munoz was at that meeting as well. They're very concerned, and many of the, they're not my constituents necessarily, but it's a real concern to those cities. So I encourage you to look at that, and if you can find a better approach than the one I'm offering, that's certainly fine with me, but I hope that our story is going to be compelling enough that you consider us in whatever solution you bring forward. And I'm going to let Superintendent Munoz talk about why this is a solution that I have for you today.
Superintendent Munoz, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you for a few minutes. First, I want to share with you a little bit
and
about...
If you would please state your...
Oh, excuse me. Michael Munoz, Superintendent, Rochester Public Schools.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off talking a little bit about our district and then give you some of those... cost of living comparisons that you were speaking about earlier. Our current enrollment is 16,889 students. Our district size is 218 square miles. We have 16 elementary schools, 4 middle schools, 3 high schools, and 1 alternative school. Currently, our minority enrollment is 35%. However, I'm being told that by 2020, our should be increased around 50%. Our students eligible for free and reduced lunch currently is at 36.4%. Our ESL population is 12%, and special education is 14%. Rochester is a cheaper place to live than some of the metro area, but Rochester is also more expensive than districts statewide. And some of the comparisons I did look at, Rochester compares to some of the districts that are currently receiving this this funding. Robbinsdale and North St. Paul are 1% cheaper than Rochester, with utilities being the biggest factor in the cost of living difference. When we look at Bloomington and Burnsville, they are 6% more expensive than Rochester, with housing being the biggest factor in that cost difference. However, utilities, transportation, and health are less expensive than they are in Rochester. When we look at Elk River is 3% more expensive than Rochester, with food being the biggest factor in the cost of living difference. However, once again, utilities and transportation are less expensive in Elk River than they are in Rochester. When we look at Maplewood is 3% more expensive than Rochester. And once again, food being the biggest factor in the cost of living difference. However, utilities, transportation, and health are less expensive than they are Rochester. We look at Eagan is 9% more expensive than Rochester, with housing being the biggest factor in the cost of living difference. However, once again, utilities, transportation, and health are more expensive in Rochester. Recently, our district CFO attended the annual Government Training Academy, and they provided some information about the lowest premium cost, MSUR individual premium. This is unsubsidized. Area 1, which is Rochester, if we look at the and comparing that to the Area 8, when we look at the bronze plan, it is $760 in Area 1. In Area 8, it's $380. We look at the silver plan, it's $956 in Area 1, $565 in Area 8. The gold plan is $1,058 in Area 1, $594 in Area 8. And then the platinum plan is $1,200, and Area 8 is $634. We recently, in our recent audit, what we do as part of our audit, we look at expenditures per student served compared to the four most recent years, state averages, to comparable size districts. And the districts that we use as our peer group are Bloomington, Burnsville, Elk River, Lakeville, North St. Paul, Robbinsdale, South Washington County. We compare ourselves to them because they're similar to our size. When we look at the information from 2012, as far as the cost for districts and school administration and support services, Rochester per pupil spends $878, whereas our peer group spends $804, and the state average is $823. When we look at our cost for site and buildings equipment, Rochester spends $880, our peer group is $770, and the state average is $802. Transportation, we spend $614, whereas the state average is $608. Community Service Department, Rochester is $557. Our peer group is $551, and the state average is $526. We anticipate the growth of Rochester due to the DMC that we're all very familiar with will likely increase not only our enrollment, the size of the city, but also increase the cost of living, which would therefore decrease the difference between Rochester and some of the metro districts. I'd also like to mention, and I agree with my colleague who just spoke with you, and I'm coming from two districts that share that. I came from Des Moines, Iowa, which is a district of 32,000 students. 69% of our students qualified for free and reduced lunch, and 51% of our students were students of color. I've given you statistics of Rochester. I can tell you from my experiences in both of those districts, it does cost more to educate those types of students. And I know this is focusing more on the cost of living, so I shared some of that information with you, but I can tell you from experience it is more expensive to educate those type of student populations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most of you on this committee know that as a general rule, I really admire wealth and success and would like to emulate it throughout Minnesota. But I can't for the life of me understand why this committee would even consider a wealth-based enhanced funding stream which would exacerbate the inequality of public education in Minnesota. It just hits me over the head how almost absurd this is. Specifically, I've become gradually more involved with teacher recruitment and retention, and it deals with the achievement gap. It deals with test scores. It deals with the quality of instruction. And the quality of, and we should strive for equality in instruction rather than to continue the gap. And frankly, by in listening to the testimony about how hard it is to recruit and retain teachers to high wealth school district boggles my mind, and I wonder what it is we end up with as a state. Are those high quality teachers who have come out of teacher preparatory institutions at the top of their classes, where are they going? Are they going to Greater Minnesota that don't have as much wealth, or are they going to districts of wealth? I think they're going to districts of wealth, and I think that contributes to the less than equal nature of instruction, and this proposal and the rest of these seem to me like it would be our policy to continue that. I really think we should back up a little bit and really analyze what's going on here. Thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you draft that bill, and I think I would look at being a co on that.
Now I am getting nervous.
And I agree, and I think it's silly, the cost of a home. Having been on the school board, I do have an appreciation for where they brought up the medical costs, because when we looked at the budget, and I also was on negotiating contracts, you know, the top dollar amount on the budget, salaries. The second was the health benefits. And, you know, that being such a portion, that would be... I do have appreciation for the fact that, you know, the testifier mentioned, you know, they're twice the diversity of the state. They neglected to mention that, 76 different languages are spoken. These are things that are valid when you're talking about the cost of providing education in a location. Textbooks, and I use the example of chalk, but... I've been laughed at for years because, you know, we haven't used chalk for a long time.
Yeah.
But you know, the normal components and expenses are pretty even. So that there's salary, health care, and a few things that are different. There are additional programs, and I wish we did it that way, because a child is a child, no matter what their zip code, where they live. I see these bills because of the way the system is. And playing within the rules and the way the formula is set up, there is some justification for trying to point out the inconsistencies. I mean, when we've got, if you just happen to be in a county, in the metro, and I remember it wasn't that long ago we had districts moving where their office was located in order to qualify for aid. And those are the kind of games that we shouldn't be wasting our time with or causing our school administrators to waste their time on. But if we're going to be consistent, then it would be consistent to cover, you know, at least the fiscal note. I can't look at the fiscal note because it's not valid, because the verbiage is located partially or wholly within a city of the first class. They only named two school districts, and I know that's incorrect. There are multiple school districts. But it is at least consistent with the approach and verbiage that we're used to in the statute. It also would be consistent if it was counties that contained. And I think when we look at bills, we need to be consistent instead of just looking at the I get mine in there. Because if we're not going to change the system, then we can at least make the system appear to be consistent and fair within what we classify as guidelines or parameters. So I look forward to working with members across the aisle to come up with a better system that first looks at the children and their needs and is blind to what their mascot is.
Representative Norton, comments here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, as I started my comments, the whole idea of education funding needs to be looked at, and we tried to do that several years ago, and we haven't gotten there. So we have the system we have. I'm here to really talk about the difference or the similarities, really, between our community as a new city of the first class and similar communities in the Twin Cities metro area. And there are similarities, as was shared in regional centers. We're facing, in fact, the story that Representative Dornholt said was, I stood up in, not this room, a room upstairs a number of years ago as a school board member saying, this is Rochester. It sounded very much like the testimony I gave just a few years ago. And we've changed drastically since then and have continued to grow. So I'm sympathetic to what he's saying. And I'm just going to say, I'm taking you way back, but my initial step into advocacy was as state PTA president. And my job was to talk about education for all children in the state of Minnesota. That's the basis I come from. But I can tell you, over all the last 20-some years, I started with that advocacy and moved to where I am today. They aren't, a child is a child, but the education systems and the schools and the districts that serve those children have very different needs, and we cannot ignore that. So what I'm bringing today is to say, as a city of the first class, we have issues. We have a large transportation area that we have to drive students from, 200 square miles. That isn't true of all districts, so that's a greater need for us. We pay our starting teachers just over $30,000 a year. If they happen to be a teacher that has children, it's in the poverty level. I mean, think about it. If you've got two kids and you're the major breadwinner in your household and you're an early first-year teacher, you're living in just over $30,000 a year. I mean, our insurance costs are more, our housing costs are more than they are in rural Minnesota, and that's just a fact. I'm not trying to take anything away from those districts. I think they have a claim, and as I said, I think the donut hole needs to be taken care of too. But our district does have differences, and I'm just bringing that, as I said, one option for you to consider as you move ahead with fixing the formula.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Norton. What we're going to do is we've got Representative Wills, and then I'm going to go to public testifiers, and we're going to move the bill. Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing the bill forward for us to review, Representative Norton. And I appreciate the discussion that we've had, and I think it's a very complex issue. So I appreciate you trying to address it. But I do have a few questions as I'm looking at the fiscal note. Well, first, my first question is, I'm just not familiar with the phrase, a city of the first class. Is that defined in statute?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
I just hadn't heard of it before, so thank you. And then my questions on the fiscal note, and I'm looking at it, and it looks like Rochester is the only one that's going to be affected by this bill. But it doesn't break it down as much as I'd like to see. And I'm wondering, what would be the levy increase for the city of Rochester, and then how much would that be per household in the city of Rochester?
Representative Norton, do you have that information?
Yeah, I don't have that information with me. We just got the fiscal note last night, and it does, you know, the bill does reference located partially or wholly within the city, and you're right, there are other communities, and it might have to do with which districts have levies and how much they have, like I said, I just got this last night, and I don't have that information. I'd be happy to delve into it, or perhaps, you know, one of the research staff could explain that for us.
Mr. Stroman, I think the levy shows total for the whole bill to about $2.9 million increase levy.
2.873.
Yeah. Okay. So any further, Representative Wills?
Just if Mr. Strom might have available for us a breakdown on how much that would be per household in an increase in property
taxes. Mr. Strom, well, he's working on that. Superintendent Munoz, did you have?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to respond to the representative's comment. I do agree a quality teacher is number one. There's a lot of research that will show that you have to have a quality teacher to get at the achievement gap, and I agree with that 100%. However, one of the things that we deal with is we have to, our employees, we're competing with the other businesses in Rochester. For example, we were constantly losing our tech people to Mayo Clinic and others, and we said we have to do a study. Why is that? And when we compared our salaries to what they were getting paid in the area, we were way under, so we had to increase those salaries. We're currently just finished a clerical study we've done. We're way under what clerical people are getting paid in Rochester and other businesses. So we do have to compete not only with other districts, but we have to compete with businesses in our community in order to keep good people that we have in our system.
Thank you much. Mr. Strom, answer to Representative Wills.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wills, the preliminary data shows about a $2.7 million levy increase for the Rochester schools. I think Representative Dabney mentioned the average price house in a Rochester area was about $160,000. Using that value of home and the $2.7 million a levy gives about a $30 per year annual change in the taxes in that community.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone here that would like to testify for or against House File 2585? If not, Representative Norton, final comment?
Superintendent Munoz might like to make a closing comment. Is that
okay,
right?
Okay, very good. Superintendent Munoz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just, you did mention it was about a $30 increase. I would like to share with you that in the past 3 years, we have not raised the property tax for our community. Actually, we've lowered it 1 year considerably. And so we, in the last 3 years, we've been able to maintain that property tax, so the impact on our community.
Very good.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Norton. I move House File 2585 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you so much. We are going to move now to House File 2544. Representative Benson, if you come forward, and anyone cares to move that bill? Yeah. Representative Dabney moves House File 2544. Representative Benson, welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate very much taking the time to hear this bill. I'm probably one of the persons you should point to for causing all these difficulties. I was the chief author of that bill, although I did have a co-conspirator, Representative Dabney, on the tax committee.
Representative Benson, you do have an author's amendment.
I do.
Someone move. Representative Dabney moves the A1 amendment. This is the put it in order. What Representative Benson, what does the A1 amendment do?
It's just a technical. The reference was unneeded. So we're just cleaning up a little.
Very good. Any other debate or questions on that? Otherwise, I'm going to call for a vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to make a couple of brief comments, and then Mr. Grunquist here will maybe expand a little on it. This bill does two things. One, it cleans up some language so that the department is able to carry on this program without constantly recalculating all the numbers. So that's an important aspect of the bill. The second is to deal with a real need or a failure in a sense of the original language, referring to what we call the donut hole. There are a group of districts up to about 60, I believe, Mr. Grunquist, whose student population are between 1,000 and 2,000 who were not included in the location equity formula. And so this bill takes care of that. Those, Mr. Chair, are the two key ingredients. As far as discussing again whether or not the notion of location equity index makes sense, I would just refer the committee again to the Minnesota Department of Education Finance Working Group recommendations and reports. And if you turn to Section 9, there's a discussion there recognizing regional cost differences. And I think those these are legitimate arguments to be made. And as you know, Mr. Chair, I had served on the Education Finance Committee when former Chair Mindy Greiling was the chair. And this was an issue that she had worked with and on for many years, and being one of her acolytes, I agree with the general notion that location equity does make sense. So with that, Mr. Chair, I turn over to my testifier.
Very good. Mr. Grunquist, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Scott Grunquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Representative Benson's bill. And I'd like to just start out by thanking Representative Benson, Representative Dabney, Representative Anzel, who served on that tax conference committee.
Mr. Chair, I believe that Mr. Anzel is demurring.
But it's, I mean, you should all be proud of that tax bill, because combined with your education bill you approved last year, I think last session really was worthy of being called the education session. You are very familiar with the great work you did in your education finance bill, and in the tax bill had some very key pieces as well, the enhanced equalization, the $300 board approved, and the location equity. And in fact, if you look at the recommendations of the Education Finance Working Group, if you look at the education bill and the tax bill, you accomplished virtually all of the recommendations on that list. So it was, we think it was remarkable work. There gets to be a lot of confusion, a lot of misperceptions whenever this topic comes up. And I think because it was in the tax bill last year, there was a perception that it came out of nowhere and hadn't been discussed. And I think those of you that have been around know that, in fact, this has been discussed for at least a decade. In fact, if you go back, I think the first time it was, well, not even the first time, but Governor Pawlenty had a task force that recommended that location equity or some kind of mechanism to recognize regional cost differentials should be adopted. The PS Minnesota study, the Hamline University School of Business, the Hubert Humphrey School had graduate students that worked on this that came up with formula recommendations. So the point is it's been around a long time, and there's been wide agreement that the cost of doing business differential does exist. And I think it's better to focus on that term cost of business as opposed to cost of living, because you start to mix issues, I think. We start to talk about the price of a gallon of milk or bread or things like that. What it is really trying to address is the cost of doing business for school districts. And as you all know, the number one expenditure, far and away up to maybe 80% of a school district's budget, is tied up in salaries and personnel. And so as you can see in the one handout in your pack, it shows that salary differential by economic region across the state of Minnesota, and it does show that real difference in salaries. And so this is a cost that school districts incur, and they really have no control over it. You know, that's the labor market in which they live, in which they need to pay salaries. So Representative Brainard talked about how the earlier versions of this had an index, and that version, and in the new Minnesota Miracle Bill, really provided all new money. I mean, it set up an index and then and distributed new money to school districts. Well, as the Education Finance Working Group was deliberating and doing research, they came to the conclusion that, you know, really, school districts have taken it upon themselves, at least in part, to address this cost differential. They've done it by going out and passing operating referendums. So they said maybe an index is not the right way to go, but we still need to address it, because it's not fair that you have some school districts that have to pass a referendum just to pay for that higher cost of doing business. So that's how they arrived at the recommendation. And if you look, so it's the second page in your handout here, and if you flip it over, it's recommendation number 9, which was right out of their report, said instead of making these districts rely on a voter-approved referendum, let's say we're going to move 400 for Metro, 200 for Greater Minnesota, larger regional centers, from the voter-approved referendum over to board-approved. So it's stable. It's not something that they could lose, if they had a negative outcome in an election. And it recognizes the fact that that's just part of doing business for them, and they need to depend on that revenue. So you can see in the recommendation, they recommended the 400, 200. So, you know, those numbers translated into 424 and 212 after the pupil weight changes that were included in the bill. The working group recommended that location equity revenue be an ongoing program, and so that's what Representative Benson's bill would accomplish here, in addition to addressing the donut hole issue. If you keep paging through the handout, you'll see that one that's titled Fiscal 14 Referendum Revenue by Strata. And so you'll see that's broken down by the different geographic regions. And if you move over to the third column from the right, the referendum revenue per pupil, you will see that the metro districts have referendums on average about twice as high as their non-metro counterparts. So they, in other words, rely on the referendum about twice as much as non-metro districts. And finally, the last page, and this is just a summary that of the chart that Mr. Strom provided, but it shows you the outcome then, or the impact of the big changes that were in that tax bill. So the board-approved referendum and the location equity revenue. And this, I think, answers if there's a perception that this was somehow a windfall for metropolitan school districts. You'll notice that basically there was $33 million in new revenue that came out of that bill. $25 million went to non-metro districts. Three-fourths of the new revenue was for non-metro districts. Now Representative Ansel's a little happier about serving on that committee. It was a good bill. I mean, absolutely, great provision. If you go to the right-hand column, you'll see that the big beneficiaries in terms of some tax relief were the metro districts, because that was them moving from voter-approved referendum to board-approved and higher equalization rate. So we think it provided a very nice balance. Some tax relief were the metro districts, because that was them moving from voter-approved referendum to board-approved and higher equalization rate. So we think it provided a very nice balance. It implemented virtually all of the recommendations of the working group, which, again, was composed of finance experts, school business managers, metro, rural, urban, suburban, from all around the state. Mm-hmm. And then my just final point, obviously there are some issues in terms of, you might qualify or not qualify, and if adjustments need to be made there, certainly, we think that's reasonable to look at. St. Cloud, I think, raises a good point, Rochester, that they do have some issues that really their districts look a little more like metro than they do like some rural districts, and special ed costs are another huge factor, and that formula is largely driven by salaries, and as you all know, we're not funding the special ed program at the level we should. So, but I would just say, just finally, that I hope we're not under the illusion that location equity revenue is the only formula we have that has these kind of cutoffs. I mean, every formula virtually we have has, whether it's sparsity or compensatory, you know, these formulas, just the way they are, have cutoffs, and you might qualify or you might not. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your consideration.
Very good. We've got one person to ask the question, and then I'm going to go to the audience, and then we're going to move to the next bill, because there's three testifiers that have come from some distance on the next one, too. So, Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, I just want to say that I understand the desire of AMSD and education establishment to move from voter-approved to board-approved. I'm sure there's members of the legislature that would like to go from voter-approved to board-approved as well. But there's nothing to be afraid of the voters, okay? So I understand the stability piece of this, but I think the more we talk down the fact that voters want to know what their school districts are doing and approve that, I think that is a real disservice to taxpayers. But more particular about location equity aid. So as we're talking about that, everybody that's testified so far has said this is a problem with salaries, right? How do we know that if 80% of the cost of these schools is in salaries, that if we do this, 80% of that's going to go to teachers and their salaries, and not administrators and their salaries, not other top-end staff and their salaries, not the superintendents, not everybody else that seems to be doing very well while our teachers aren't getting those salaries? How do we know that? And do we have any evidence that that's happened in the past?
Representative Benson?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Woodward, you know, one of the views I've always had is that if we have elected school boards, elected by the parents of the children who attended those schools, and if we believe in local control, and the 8 years I've been here, I've never heard anyone say, no, we want it all centrally directed from St. Paul. But when it comes down to it, everybody's practically finds a way to question whether those school board members are going to do the right thing, and that we need State St. Paul to oversee every little digit and dot that they may support or vote for. My answer to you is I trust local school boards to do that. They have to attract qualified personnel, whether they're administrators, whether they're teachers, whether they're counselors, whatever position they need to fill, and I just have confidence that for the most part they're going to make the right decision. And if they don't, then the alternative is to turn to the voters and they can find another school board. So that's number one. And the second one, I'd just like to mention briefly, Mr. Chair, I know you're pressed for time. And that is, I would agree with you that it's important that school boards, when they raise funds for their schools, that they are being carefully monitored by the voters. But I don't believe a referenda originally were ever designed to be for operating schools. I consider referenda to be used only for capital investments for the most part. A new school building, computers for the schools, that kind of thing. And the fact that school districts like mine that I represent and so many others in this state over the last 10, 15, 20 years have had to depend on operating referenda, I consider an indictment of the state legislature and the state of Minnesota for not providing adequate funding for the schools, which under the Constitution of the state of Minnesota we are obligated to do. So that's my answer for that part of it.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick one. I think we agree on local control. Just the ultimate local control is the voter. That is the ultimate local control. And then secondarily, if we believe that the education system, we talked about this last week, is so underfunded, then perhaps that tax cut bill or the tax correction bill shouldn't have been passed. Only two votes against it. And if that was the case, then that money should have gone into the education system so that Mr. Kroonquist could come and testify next year that we have a fully funded education system. So, and I'm done.
Yeah, no, I just wasn't going to entertain other questions at this point. So,
Mr. Chair,
you'll have a last word. Seconds. Let's go this way, and we'll have a last word. Is there any public testimony for or against 2544? Very good. Representative Benson.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to carry on this dialogue too long, other than to say the general population was made up by a majority of parents who go to the polls, then I would agree. But we have, in many districts, mine for example, maybe 25, 26, 27% of the voting public are parents who have children in the schools. And with all the pressures on the economy that we've seen these last few years and for the last 20, 30 years, in which such a large proportion of the population have not seen an increase in their buying power, it is pretty difficult for people there to go and vote for what is essential for kids. They don't always do it. They're already strapped. And the one little area they can protest the economic conditions they find themselves in often is to go to the voting booth and vote down school referendum. And we have a constitutional obligation to provide an adequate education for every child, regardless. So I believe in democracy, too. But I want equity for children.
Thank you. I'm going to move House File 2544 be laid over for possible inclusion into the education finance bill. Thank you very much, Representative Benson. Would Representative Radenovich, would you like to move House File 2547?
I would like to move House File 2547.
All right. And I think this one now is the 424. This is the everyone gets the 424.
This is the everyone gets the same amount one. And I've been holding back my comments, chomping at the bit over here. I mean, this is obviously very a ripe debate, and I think that it's one worth having. But I would say, in listening to some of the comments that I've heard earlier, that we have a fundamental inequality based on location in this state that yet persists, despite our best efforts during the last session. And it was exacerbated by the policies of the legislature over the last 10 years. And so while we can lament the situation as it is and some of the band-aids that have been put on it, I mean, it is a direct result of not keeping up with equalization statewide over the last 10 years while we haven't kept pace with the cost of inflation in educating our students here in Minnesota. This bill grants every district the authority to levy up to $424 under the Location Equity Revenue Program. Now, what I would make is the argument that the boards making these decisions are accounting for the cost of doing business in their area. But the issue is that fundamentally still it costs more to levy in certain places in the state than it does in other places in the state. So the best location equity, in my opinion, are fully equalized levies and giving each district the same set of tools to go out there and provide an education for their students. I think that this bill accomplishes that, or at least one of those goals, in allowing each district to levy up to $424. Now, there's been some discussion about board authority, and I found an interesting quote that it caught my eye a few weeks ago, and it became relevant today in this discussion. But the Beltrami County GOP had recently passed a resolution, and the resolution in its text said, "We hereby renounce democracy in the democratic form of government and reaffirm the republic and the republican form of government given us by the people and the founding fathers. We are a democracy only to the extent that the majority elects its representation." And so in putting the hand, putting the power back in the school boards, we're fundamentally empowering the most local government that we have to educate the students. But again, the inequalities persist, and I think that this bill puts one tool back in the toolbox for those districts who've been dealing with some of the education trends in the state. So with that, I got most of it off my chest right now, but I'll defer to some of my guest testifiers here.
Okay, so welcome.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Olson. I'm the superintendent of schools in St. Peter. St. Peter is located 65 miles southwest of Minneapolis on Highway 169. We border the Mankato School District, Representative Reinert, and the Cleveland, Nicollet, and Lee Sir Henderson School District. So we are literally in this donut hole that we talk about. I really want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify in support of the expansion of location equity revenue. There are really two reasons why I think it is important to provide that access to our school district. First, location equity revenue allows greater fairness for our taxpayers. we're a relatively low property wealth school district, and the extension of location equity revenue with its higher level of equalization will allow for approximately $100,000 in relief for the taxpayers of our district. I think that relief is as important in St. Peter as it is in Mankato or in any other district that receives location equity revenue. I think our taxpayers, again, need the access to higher levels of equalization regardless of the numbers of students in our district. We have about 1,900 students in our school district that we serve K-12. We have about 250 students we serve in our early childhood programs, and we also serve populations at the Minnesota State Security Hospital. The second reason that I would support the expansion of location equity revenue and urge you to do so as well has to do with what I would call the cost of doing the right thing. It's those kinds of programs that we're able to offer when we have a stable and predictable system of funding, and we don't have to worry about the potential of our taxpayers saying no to an extension of our operating levies. I can give you several examples of that. We have a kindergarten ready program that we operate with our general fund dollars. It's a program that is focused on those students who are 5 years old, primarily March through August birthdays, not quite ready for kindergarten. So we offer more of a traditional half-day kindergarten program for those students rather than our full-day program that we offer for other students who enter our kindergarten. That program has really made a difference in helping our students be kindergarten ready. In addition, we offer summer academic programs for our students grades K through 8. We know that one of the biggest differences in educational achievement for students has to do with summer learning loss, and that summer learning loss is much greater for students who have lower economic means to support them. We've been very successful in helping more of our students be successful in reading and math skills as they enter the third grade and in closing the achievement gap. Proud to tell you that we met or exceeded all of the achievement gap targets for our school district this past year. In addition, as we move into our high school program, it's really important that we have our students career and college ready. One of the programs that you heard mentioned earlier is the AVID program, Advancement via Individual Determination. It's a program that targets students in the middle, and we begin that student program in ninth grade. And it focuses on taking students who maybe haven't had college as an option to consider and really putting that in front of them as a goal for them to attain. We're now in our third year. I was in an AVID classroom a week ago, and I was just amazed at the work that the students are doing as they are really now focusing on taking the most rigorous courses in our high school and are focused on going to college. And finally, I'll mention we have two academy programs that are designed to make sure that our students are career ready. We have an agricultural education academy and a health occupations academy. We think those programs are meeting regional demands for employment and also getting our students to understand the wide array of options in those career areas. These are programs that only come about because we have that stable and predictable source of school funding. And I think location equity revenue allows us to continue that. So with that, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate it.
Superintendent Olson, thank you. And Representative Johnson has talked to me a lot about this issue, as you might know.
Thank you.
So thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity also. I have been able to bend your ear for a number of years on a particular issue, and I appreciate your gracious nature.
Superintendent Wanick, would you
introduce
yourself?
I'm Deb Wanick, Superintendent of the Pelican Rapids School District. I feel I've been a little bit remiss in not telling my full story, and I appreciate this opportunity. I'd like to start with a little first grade story because I think it depicts education so well. There was a first grade classroom going through fire safety, and we had some firemen in the classroom working with the children. And at the end, the firefighter said, "So, what would you do if your clothes were on fire?" And the little boy looked at him strange, and the firefighter was expecting the child to say, "We would stop, drop, and roll." And so he asked the question again, "What would you do if your clothes were on fire?" And the little boy looked at him and said, "Well, I wouldn't put them on." And I think the preciousness, the innocence, and the sincerity of that child really drives us to really want to make the best for that child. We have our small school, we're less than 1,000 students, but we are much like the metro area in that we have 40%, almost 40% minority students. And recent numbers, we have over 50% free and reduced. So we have a real diverse population, which we love, and it's been great, gives us a great world view, but we have those challenges, especially with academics. And we've been making progress. But, you know, when you only have 9 months, everything has to be so intentional. And we work on having fun, but everything with our Common Core, when you're learning the English language and you have the Common Core depth to know, it's a lot of work. We're making progress. We were a focus school and no longer a focus school, so that is exciting for us. But when you look at the finance side, when I came, I've been there 7 years, I realized we were going into a downward spiral pretty quickly. And so within the first 3 years, we had to cut $1.2 million. When you think you have 1,000 students, those are really drastic cuts. We lost programs and the staff. We had larger class sizes. We did try to run a levy, and it failed, and we ran the levy again. And we did not want our teachers involved very much in running these levies because we knew the intentionality that they had to have in the classroom. And it's very hard for a teacher to come out and say, we need the money, because you know what? That 80% of the money coming to the district funds my salary. So the third time, we brought them in, but the fourth time we said, okay, we have spent much of our fund balance. We need everybody out. And it passed on the fourth attempt. You know, somebody, when we were 3 years into this, my term there, our test scores dropped, and I was just devastated because we have all these instructional programs district-wide that we have been so careful to impart into our program. And a superintendent said, well, you've had a failed levy. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, if you pass a levy, your scores will go up. He said, if I ever do my doctorate, I want to do my doctorate on that. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. Well, you know what? The next year, our levy passed, and our math scores went up 7%. Now, fluke, it could be. It could be positive morale. It could be that the teachers were truly focused in the classroom. And that makes a big difference. Well, you know, right after that happens, we pass our levy, we had to address our building. We have parts of our building that were built in 1928. We had parts that were condemned. We could no longer go in. So we tried to pass the levy again, not using our teachers. And when it's just the school board, some parents, and myself, it just didn't pass. We got all our teachers involved, and it passed quite well. Well, I've been there this year. It's my seventh year, and we've run six levies. So you know where my time and attention has been. And now, when we passed our levy, it was for 5 years. Because we worked so hard to get it where something would be acceptable to the public. Now this fall, I have to go out and ask for a renewal. So that is really hard when we think we're trying so hard to work on our achievement gap. And where is my time and energy? You know, when you go through schooling, you get a lot about curriculum and instruction. You don't spend a lot of time about how to run an election. And I have a great deal of respect for you who have to run for election because it's not something that I value doing at all. So, you know, I appreciate the complexities when you've been talking how when you look at school financing, I can't believe that there's anything like it that can have so many pieces and so complicated. And the equity piece is so hard. And I know that the Metro talks about the higher level of expense and their homes and investments in their homes takes more.
Ms. Wanick, if you could kind of wrap this up, please. We've got I know, three more testifiers here, and we've got about 5 minutes.
Okay, 2 seconds more. It's just that when we look at funding, you have alternative facility funds for the Metro. When there were integration dollars, it was three times more than what we had. You have access to broadband, and when you look at the referendum market value, it's much more even, where 50% of our referendum market value was taken away. So again, I just really appreciate if you look at this. It's not new money for my district. It would just relieve us from not having to go out and ask again.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that. Superintendent Hansen, and then we've got Mr. Walseth and Mr. Lundell, and so if we could keep these comments to about
two minutes,
thank you, and then, all right, very good. Please introduce yourself. And
Chairman Mark Park, committee members. Okay, here we go. I'm Jerry Hansen, Superintendent of Schools, Mille Lacs Public Schools. The location equity revenue proposed in this bill is critical for districts like Mille Lacs, for districts in outstate Minnesota, and to start to bring about equity in educational funding.
Last January, one of the manufacturing plants in Mille Lacs was destroyed by fire. As a result, the University of Minnesota Extension Service did an economic impact study for us. Interesting data came out of that. In that study, it was found that the average wage and benefit package in Mille Lacs County was $35,300. The average wage and benefit package for the rest of greater Minnesota was $62,600. We pay the same for propane. When it comes to per capita income, Mille Lacs County is ranked 86th out of the 87 counties in the state of Minnesota. Despite being fiscally poor, our community is rich in its support and pride for their schools. When our school board passed the $300 authorized levy last year, not a single board member or administrator received one word of complaint from the community. Those funds are being used today and next year to reduce class size, to reduce caseloads in special ed. We have 18% of our children with special needs. Those funds will also be used to increase elective and core class opportunities for our secondary kids. They'll be used to bolster our early childhood program, to align curriculum instruction and testing practices throughout the school district, to strengthen our reading program for our youngest readers that are struggling the most. Those funds will be well spent. Those funds were important to the success of our students, but there is much more we must do to continue to make our students competitive for colleges and careers with those students who will be graduating from around the state, the country, and the world. Location equity revenue will be just as vital to our students and our taxpayers who happen to live in a property-poor district. Location equity revenue will allow us in the future to focus on college and career readiness, technology, additional opportunities to challenge our students, ensure classroom equipment and materials are adequate, and that programs are in place to meet the needs of all of our students. Your support for this bill is critical for the success of our students today as they continue to compete on the state and national stages of tomorrow. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Superintendent Hansen. Mr. Lundell, if I'm going to give you about 40 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. I want to thank Representative Radinovich, also Representative Benson, Representative Dorholt, and Representative Norton for introducing their bills. As you know, applying a straightforward concept can often create a number of complications, and that appears what have happened here. About a quarter of our C-member school districts are affected by the donut hole. Some of them would receive new revenue. Some of them would simply, as in the case of Superintendent Wanick, be able to board approve referendum levy as opposed to going to the voters. We tend toward the universal approaches that are proposed by Representative Radinovich and Representative Benson. I think, though, all these bills kind of show how something needs to be done with this. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Walseth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Walseth.
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth, Minnesota Rural Education Association. I do understand time is of the essence, and a lot has been said. I've been trying to slice and dice my testimony here. I just want to go back to the general concept here, and a lot has been referenced about the department's task force, PS Minnesota, going back before I graduated from high school. But there has been a lot of discussion about a baseline amount of district-level fiscal tool to support the educational programs in the state. I think the dilemma you have with the implementation of small schools revenue in 11 and LER in 13 is that you do have a gap where some districts do not have a district level fiscal policy to be able to shore up a revenue base for their basic operations. And I think that's what we're here today with the Radinovich bill and even Representative Benson's bill too that would extend a portion of that to all districts. I think there's seems to be a general acknowledgement by at least those two authors that there should be some broad-based district-level fiscal tool for all schools. And the reason for that, Mr. Chairman, I know we can talk about economic baskets of goods and who has what and who doesn't, but every single school district lives under the same collective bargaining requirements, the same teacher licensure requirements, the same special education requirements. And you can see that reflected in, over the last decade, the amount of referendum authority that is out there in school districts, as Ms. Wanick was referring to. And by strata that you see in committee often, non-metro districts with more than 2,000 kids have an average of $663 per pupil. District non-metro districts between 1 and 2,000 are at 613 average per pupil. Non-metro districts with fewer than 1,000 kids are 868. And as Mr. Kronquist testified, the metro area is about double those rural rates. And
Mr.
So,
Walseth, can you finish this up?
I can. I just okay. We're here just to say we all have a baseline amount of district costs that are outside of our control, outside of their control, and we need that fiscal policy extended to all school districts in some manner. And Mr. Chair, just with the Representative Benson bill, we would ask if that were the approach that those districts qualifying for small schools revenue would be given a choice between LER or small schools. The curvilinear structure of small schools makes it disadvantageous for a certain about 15 or 20 districts in that group where they would prefer LER over SSR.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Representative Woodard, would you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question for the author. Representative Rodinovich, if we're going to do this, why do we still call it location equity revenue when it seems like it's just an add to the formula?
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, in all honesty, I think that by empowering local school boards to make decisions about the cost of living and the necessary, expenses that they have, in that way, there's location accountants. I'm not tied to the name personally, but I do believe that we ought to give these school boards the fiscal tool necessary to make the decisions at the local board. I think the consistency in application across the state is important, and, I think this bill addresses that.
Is there anyone here that cares to testify for or against House File 2547? Representative Dietrich, you have like 20 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I can do it in 20 seconds, too. First of all, we want to thank the legislature for passing LER last legislative session, but still there are very many questions throughout the state about whether this was truly equitable or not. And so we would support the Rodinovich bill because we do think that it adds equity back into the location equity piece, and that it as Representative Benson says, if you give the local control back, give the power back to the local control, they can make local decisions based on their own location, their own expenses, their own revenue, and they would make the appropriate decisions, and they might take zero, and they might take the full amount, but at least it allows them to react to their situations individually.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else here from the audience for or against? We've got several members on both sides of the aisle that would like to speak. We're not going to have time for that. So I am going to, any last comments there, Representative Rodinovich?
I think that we need to look at the fiscal tools at the school board level. It provides consistency in application education across the state, and I hope that this is a consideration for this committee going forward. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I move House File 2547 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you for the debate today. We are adjourned.